From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Shadows on the Wall by Mary E. Wilkins Freeman. Henry had words with Edward in the study the night before Edward died, said Carolyn Glynn. She spoke not with acrimony, but with grave severity. Rebecca Ann Glynn gasped by way of assent. She sat in a wide flounce of black silk in the corner of the sofa and rolled terrified eyes from her sister Caroline to her sister, Mrs. Stephen Brigham, who had been Emma Glynn, the one beauty of the family. The latter was beautiful still, with a large, splendid, full-blown beauty. She filled a great rocking chair with a superb bulk of femininity and swayed gently back and forth, her black silks whispering and her black frills fluttering. Even the shock of death, for her brother Edward lay dead in the house, could not disturb her outward serenity of demeanor. But even her expression of masterly placidity changed before her sister Caroline's announcement and her sister Rebecca Ann's gasp of terror, distress, and response. I think Henry might have controlled his temper when poor Edward was so near his end, she said with an asperity which disturbed slightly the roseate curves of her beautiful mouth. Of course he did not know, murmured Rebecca Ann in a faint tone. Of course he did not know it, said Caroline quickly. She turned on her sister with a strange sharp look of suspicion. Then she shrank, as if from the other's possible answer. Rebecca gasped again. The married sister, Mrs. Emma Brigham, was now sitting up straight in her chair. She had ceased rocking and was eyeing them both intently with a sudden accentuation of family likeness in her face. "What do you mean?" said she impartially to them both. Then she, too, seemed to shrink before a possible answer. She even laughed, an evasive sort of laugh. "Nobody means anything," said Caroline firmly. She rose and crossed the room toward the door with grim decisiveness. "Where are you going?" asked Mrs. Brigham. "I have something to see to," replied Caroline, and the others at once knew by her tone that she had some solemn and sad duty to perform in the chamber of death. "Oh," said Mrs. Brigham. After the door had closed behind Caroline, she turned to Rebecca. "Did Henry have many words with him?" she asked. "They were talking very loud," replied Rebecca evasively. Mrs. Brigham looked at her. She had not resumed rocking. She sat up straight with a slight knitting of intensity on her fair forehead between the pretty rippling curves of her auburn hair. "Did you ever hear anything?" she asked in a low voice with a glance towards the door. "I was just across the hall in the south parlor, and that door was open and this door ajar," replied Rebecca with a slight flush. "Then you must have." "I couldn't help it." "Everything?" "Most of it." "What was it?" "The old story." "I suppose Henry was mad, as he always was, because Edward was living on here for nothing when he had wasted all the money father left for him." Rebecca nodded with a fearful glance at the door. When Emma spoke again, her voice was still more hushed. "I know how he felt," said she. "It must have looked to him as if Edward was living at his expense. But he wasn't." "No, he wasn't. And Edward had a right here according to the terms of father's will, and Henry ought to have remembered it." "Yes, he ought." "Did he say hard things?" "Pretty hard from what I heard." "What?" "I heard him tell Edward that he had no business here at all, and he thought he had better go away." "What did Edward say?" "That he would stay here as long as he lived, and afterwards too," if he was a mind to, and he would like to see Henry get him out. And then? What? Then he laughed. What did Henry say? I didn't hear him say anything, but what? I saw him when he came out of this room. He looked mad. You've seen him when he looked so. Emma nodded. The expression of horror on her face had deepened. Do you remember that time he killed the cat because she had scratched him? Yes, don't. Then Caroline re-entered the room. She went up to the stove in which a wood fire was burning. It was a cold, gloomy day of fall, and she warmed her hands, which were reddened from recent washing in cold water. Mrs. Brigham looked at her and hesitated. She glanced at the door, which was still ajar. It did not easily shut, being still swollen with the damp weather of the summer. She rose and pushed it together with a sharp thud which jarred the house. Rebecca started painfully with a half exclamation. Caroline looked at her disapprovingly. It is time you controlled your nerves, Rebecca, she said. Mrs. Brigham returned from the closed door, said imperiously that it ought to be fixed. It shut so hard. It will shrink enough after we have had the fire a few days, replied Caroline. I think Henry ought to be ashamed of himself for talking as he did to Edward, said Mrs. Brigham abruptly, but in an almost inaudible voice. Hush, said Caroline, with a glance of actual fear at the closed door. Nobody can hear with the door shut. I say again, I think Henry ought to be ashamed of himself. I shouldn't think he'd ever get over it, having words with poor Edward the very night before he died. Edward was enough sight better disposition than Henry, with all his faults. I never heard him speak a cross word, unless he spoke cross to Henry that last night. I don't know, but he did, from what Rebecca overheard. Not so much cross, as sort of soft and sweet and aggravating, sniffed Rebecca. What do you really think ailed Edward? Asked Emma in hardly more than a whisper. She did not look at her sister. I know you said that he had terrible pains in his stomach and had spasms, but what do you think made him have them? Henry called it gastric trouble. You know, Edward has always had dyspepsia. Mrs. Brigham hesitated a moment. Was there any talk of an examination, said she. Then Caroline turned on her fiercely. No, said she in a terrible voice, no. The three sisters' souls seemed to meet on one common ground of terrified understanding through their eyes. The old-fashioned latch of the door was heard to rattle, and a push from without made the door shake ineffectually. It's Henry, Rebecca sighed rather than whispered. Mrs. Brigham settled herself, after a noiseless rush across the floor, into a rocking chair again. It was swaying back and forth, with her head comfortably leaning back, when the door at last yielded and Harry Glynn entered. He cast a covertly sharp, comprehensive glance at Mrs. Brigham with her elaborate calm, at Rebecca, quietly huddled in the corner of the sofa with her handkerchief to her face, and only one small, uncovered, reddened ear, as attentive as a dog's, and at Caroline, sitting with a strained composure in her armchair by the stove. She met his eyes quite firmly, with a look of inscrutable fear and defiance of the fear and of him. Henry Glynn looked more like this sister than the others. Both had the same hard delicacy of form and aquilinity of feature. They confronted each other with the pitiless immovability of two statues in whose marble lineaments emotions were fixed for all eternity. Then Henry Glynn smiled, and the smile transformed his face. He looked suddenly years younger, and an almost boyish recklessness appeared in his face. He flung himself into a chair with a gesture which was bewildering from its incongruity with his general appearance. He leaned his head back, flung one leg over the other, and looked laughingly at Mrs. Brigham. "I declare, Emma, you grow younger every year," he said. She flushed a little, and her placid mouth widened at the corners. She was susceptible to praise. "Our thoughts today ought to belong to the one of us who will never grow older," said Caroline in a hard voice. Henry looked at her, still smiling. "Of course, "We none of us forget that," said he in a deep, gentle voice. "But we have to speak to the living, Caroline, and I have not seen Emma for a long time, and the living are as dear as the dead." "Not to me," said Caroline. She rose and went abruptly out of the room again. Rebecca also rose and hurried after her, sobbing loudly. Henry looked slowly after them. "Caroline is completely unstrung," said he. Mrs. Brigham rocked. A confidence in him inspired by his manner was stealing over her. Out of that confidence she spoke quite easily and naturally. "His death was very sudden," said she. Henry's eyelids quivered slightly, but his gaze was unswerving. "Yes," said he, "it was very sudden. He was sick only a few hours." "What did you call it?"
"Gastric."
"You did not think of an examination?"
"There was no need. I am perfectly certain as to the cause of his death."
Suddenly Mrs. Brigham felt a creep as of some live horror over her very soul. Her flesh prickled with cold before an inflection of his voice. She rose, tottering on weak knees.
"Where are you going?" asked Henry in a strange, breathless voice.
Mrs. Brigham said something incoherent about some sewing which she had to do, some black for the funeral, and was out of the room. She went up to the front chamber which she occupied. Caroline was there. She went close to her and took her hands, and the two sisters looked at each other.
"Don't speak. Don't. I won't have it," said Caroline finally, in an awful whisper.
"I won't," replied Emma. That afternoon, the three sisters were in the study. Mrs. Brigham was hemming some black material. At last, she laid her work on her lap. "It's no use. I cannot see to sew another stitch until we have a light," said she. Caroline, who was writing some letters at the table, turned to Rebecca in her usual place on the sofa. "Rebecca, you had better get a lamp," she said. Rebecca started up. Even in the dusk, her face showed her agitation. "It doesn't seem to me that we need a lamp quite yet," she said in a piteous, pleading voice like a child's.
"Yes, we do," returned Mrs. Brigham peremptorily. "I can't see to sew another stitch."
Rebecca rose and left the room. Presently she entered with a lamp. She set it on the table, an old-fashioned card table, which was placed against the opposite wall from the window. That opposite wall was taken up with three doors. The one small space was occupied by the table.
"What have you put that lamp over there for?" asked Mrs. Brigham, with more of impatience than her voice usually revealed. "Why didn't you set it in the hall and have done with it? Neither Caroline nor I can see if it's on that table."
"I thought perhaps you would move," replied Rebecca hoarsely. "If I do move, we can't both sit at that table. Caroline has all her papers spread around. Why don't you set the lamp in the study table in the middle of the room? Then we can both see."
Rebecca hesitated. Her face was very pale. She looked with an appeal that was fairly agonizing at her sister Caroline.
"Why don't you put the lamp on this table, as she says?" asked Caroline almost fiercely. "Why do you act so, Rebecca?"
Rebecca took the lamp and set it on the table in the middle of the room without another word. Then she seated herself on the sofa and placed a hand over her eyes as if to shade them and remain so.
"Does the light hurt your eyes? And is that the reason why you didn't want the lamp?" asked Mrs. Brigham kindly.
"I always like to sit in the dark," replied Rebecca chokingly. Then she snatched her handkerchief hastily from her pocket and began to weep. Caroline continued to write, Mrs. Brigham to sew. Suddenly Mrs. Brigham, as she sewed, glanced at the opposite wall. The glance became a steady stare. She looked intently, her work suspended in her hands. Then she looked away again and took a few more stitches. Then she looked again and again turned to her task. At last she laid her work in her lap and stared concentratedly. She looked from the wall around the room, taking note of the various objects. Then she turned to her sisters.
"What is that?" said she.
"What?" asked Caroline harshly.
"That strange shadow on the wall," replied Mrs. Brigham.
Rebecca sat with her face hidden. Caroline dipped her pen in the inkstand.
"Why don't you turn around and look?" asked Mrs. Brigham in a wondering and somewhat aggrieved way.
"I'm in a hurry to finish this letter," replied Caroline shortly.
Mrs. Brigham rose, her work slipping to the floor, and began walking round the room.
moving various articles of furniture with her eyes on the shadow. Then suddenly she shrieked out, "Look at this awful shadow! What is it? Caroline, look, look! Rebecca, look, what is it?" All Mrs. Brigham's triumphant placidity was gone. Her handsome face was livid with horror. She stood stiffly pointing at the shadow. Then after a shuddering glance at the wall, Rebecca burst out in a wild wail. "Oh, Caroline, there it is again. There it is again." Caroline grinned. "You look," said Mrs. Brigham. "Look. What is that dreadful shadow?" Caroline rose, turned, and stood confronting the wall. "How should I know?" she said. "It has been there every night since he died," cried Rebecca. "Every night?" "Yes. He died Thursday and this Saturday. That makes 3 nights," said Caroline rigidly. She stood as if holding her calm with a vice of concentrated will. It looks like, stammered Mrs. Brigham in a tone of intense horror. "I know what it looks like well enough," said Caroline. "I've got eyes in my head." "It looks like Edward," burst out Rebecca in a sort of frenzy of fear. "Only..." "Yes, it does," assented Mrs. Brigham with horror-stricken tone, matching her sister's. "Only, oh, it is awful. What is it, Caroline?" "I ask you again, how should I know?" replied Caroline. "I see it like you. How should I know any more than you?" "It must be something in the room," said Mrs. Brigham, staring wildly around. "We moved everything in the room the first night it came," said Rebecca. "It is not anything in the room." Caroline turned upon her with a sort of fury. "Of course it is something in the room," said she. "How you act! What do you mean talking so? Of course it is something in the room." "Of course it is," agreed Mrs. Brigham, looking at Caroline suspiciously. "It must be something in the room." "It is not anything in the room," repeated Rebecca with obstinate horror. The door opened suddenly and Harry Glynn entered. He began to speak and his eyes followed the direction of the others. He stood staring at the shadow on the wall. "What is that?" he demanded in a strange voice. "It must be due to something in the room," Mrs. Brighton said faintly. Henry Glynn stood and stared a moment longer. His face showed a gamut of emotions, horror, conviction, and furious incredulity. Suddenly he began hastening hither and thither about the room. He moved the furniture with fierce jerks, turning ever to see the effect upon the shadow on the wall. Not a line of its terrible outlines wavered. "It must be something in the room," he declared in a voice which seemed to snap like a lash. His face changed. The inmost secrecy of his nature seemed evident upon his face, until one almost lost sight of his lineaments. Rebecca stood close to her sofa, regarding him with woeful, fascinated eyes. Mrs. Brigham clutched Caroline's hand. They both stood in a corner out of his way. For a few moments he raged about the room like a caged wild animal. He moved every piece of furniture. When the moving of a piece did not affect his shadow, he flung it to the floor. Then suddenly he desisted. He laughed. "What an absurdity," he said easily. "Such a to-do about a shadow." "That's so," assented Mrs. Brigham in a scared voice, which she tried to make sound natural. As she spoke, she lifted a chair near her. "I think you have broken the chair that Edward was fond of," said Caroline. Terror and wrath were struggling for expression on her face. Her mouth was set, her eyes shrinking. Henry lifted the chair with a show of anxiety. "Just as good as ever," he said pleasantly. He laughed again, looking at his sisters. "Did I scare you?" he said. "I should think you might be used to me by this time. You know my way of wanting to leap to the bottom of a mystery. And that shadow does look queer-like. And I thought if there was any way of accounting for it, I would like to do without any delay." "You don't seem to have succeeded," remarked Caroline dryly with a slight glance at the wall. Henry's eyes followed hers, and he quivered perceptibly. "Oh, there is no accounting for shadows," he said, and he laughed again. "A man is a fool to try to account for shadows." Then the supper bell rang, and they all left the room, but Henry kept his back to the wall, as indeed the others did. Henry led the way with an alert motion, like a boy. Rebecca brought up the rear. She could scarcely walk. Her knees trembled so. "I can't sit in that room again this evening," she whispered to Caroline after supper. "Very well, we will sit in the south room," replied Caroline. "I think we will sit in the south parlor," she said aloud. "It isn't as damp as the study, and I have a cold." So they all sat in the south room with her sewing. Henry read the newspaper, his chair drawn close to the lamp on the table. About 9 o'clock, he rose abruptly and crossed the hall to the study. The three sisters looked at one another. Mrs. Brigham rose, folded her rustling skirts compactly around her, and began tiptoeing toward the door. "What are you going to do?" inquired Rebecca agitatedly. "I'm going to see what he is about," replied Mrs. Brigham cautiously. As she spoke, she pointed to the study door across the hall. It was ajar. Henry had striven to pull it together behind him, but had somehow swollen beyond the limit with curious speed. It was still ajar, and a streak of light showed from top to bottom. Mrs. Brigham folded her skirt so tightly that her bulk, with its swelling curves, was revealed in a black silk sheath, and she went with a slow toddle across the hall to the study door. She stood there, her eye at the crack. In the south room, Rebecca stopped sewing and sat watching with dilated eyes. Caroline sewed steadily. What Mrs. Brigham, standing at the crack in the study door, saw was this. Henry Glynn, evidently reasoning that the source of the strange shadow must be between the table on which the lamp stood and the wall, was making systematic passes and thrusts with an old sword which had belonged to his father all over and through the intervening space. Not an inch was left unpierced. He seemed to have divided the space into mathematical sections. He brandished the sword with a sort of cold fury and calculation. The blade gave out flashes of light. The shadow remained unmoved. Mrs. Brigham, watching, felt herself cold with horror. Finally, Henry ceased and stood with a sword in hand and raised as if to strike, surveying the shadow on the wall threateningly. Mrs. Brigham toddled back across the hall and shut the south room door behind her before she related what she had seen. "He looked like a demon," she said again. "Have you got any of that old one in the house, Caroline? I don't feel as if I could stand much more." "Yes, there's plenty," said Caroline. "You can have some when you go to bed." "I think we had all better take some," said Mrs. Brigham. "Oh, Caroline, what—" "Don't ask. Don't speak," said Caroline. "No, I'm not going to," replied Mrs. Brigham, "but—" Soon the three sisters went to their chambers, and the south parlor was deserted. Caroline called to Henry in the study to put out the light before he came upstairs. They had been gone about an hour when he came into the room bringing the lamp which had stood in the study. He set it on the table and waited a few minutes, pacing up and down. His face was terrible. His fair complexion showed livid, and his blue eyes seemed dark blanks of awful reflections. Then he took up the lamp and returned to the library. He set the lamp on the center table, and the shadow sprang out on the wall. Again he studied the furniture and moved it about, but deliberately, with none of his former frenzy. Nothing affected the shadow. Then he returned to the south room with a lamp and again waited. Again he returned to the study and placed the lamp on the table, and the shadow sprang out upon the wall. It was midnight before he went upstairs. Mrs. Brigham and the other sisters, who could not sleep, heard him. The next day was the funeral. That evening the family sat in the south room. Some relatives were with them. Nobody entered the study until Henry carried a lamp in there after the others had retired for the night. He saw again the shadow on the wall leap to an awful life before the light. The next morning at breakfast, Henry Glynn announced that he had to go to the city for 3 days. The sisters looked at him with surprise. He very seldom left home, and just now his practice had been neglected on account of Edward's death. "How can you leave your patients now?" asked Mrs. Brigham wonderingly. "I don't know how to, but there is no other way," replied Henry easily. "I have a telegram from Dr. Mitford." "Consultation?" inquired Mrs. Brigham. "I have business," replied Henry. Dr. Mitford was an old classmate of his who lived in a neighboring city and who occasionally called upon him in the case of a consultation. After he had gone, Mrs. Brigham said to Caroline that after all, Henry had not said that he was going to consult with Dr. Mitford, and she thought it very strange. "Everything is very strange," said Rebecca with a shudder. "What do you mean?" inquired Caroline. "Nothing," replied Rebecca. "Nobody entered the study that day nor the next. The third day Henry was expected home, but he did not arrive when the last train from the city had come." "I call it pretty queer work," said Mrs. Brigham. "The idea of a doctor leaving his patients at such a time as this, and the idea of a consultation lasting 3 days. There is no sense in it. And now he has not come? I don't understand it for my part." "I don't either," said Rebecca. They all were in the south parlor. There was no light in the study. The door was ajar. Presently Mrs. Brigham rose. She could not have told why. Something seemed to impel her, some will outside her own. She went out of the room again, wrapping her rustling skirt around that she might pass noiselessly, and began pushing at the swollen door of the study. "She has not got any lamp," said Rebecca in a shaking voice. Caroline, who was writing letters, rose again, took the only remaining lamp in the room, and followed her sister. Rebecca had risen, but she stood trembling, not venturing to follow. The doorbell rang, but the others did not hear it. It was on the south door, on the other side of the house from the study. Rebecca, after hesitating until the bell rang the second time, went to the door. She remembered that the servant was out. Caroline and her sister Emma entered the study. Caroline set the lamp on the table. They looked at the wall, and there were two shadows. The sisters stood clutching each other, staring at the awful things on the wall. Then Rebecca came in, staggering with a telegram in her hand. "Here is a telegram," she gasped. "Henry is dead."
Talking in the Dark by Dennis Etchison. In the damp bedroom, Victor Rupon sat hunched over his desk, making last-minute corrections on the 9th or 10th draft. He couldn't remember which. A letter to the one person in the world who might be able to help. Outside, puppies with the voices of children struggled against their leashes for a chance to be let in from the cold. He ignored them and bore down. Their efforts at sympathy were wasted on him. He had nothing more to give. After 33 years, he had finally stepped out of the melodrama. He clicked the pen against his teeth. Since the letter was to a man he had never met, he had to be certain that his words would not seem naive or foolish. "Dear sir," he reread, squinting down at the latest version's cramped, meticulously cursive backhand. He lifted the 3-hole notebook paper by the edges so as not to risk smearing the ballpoint ink. "Dear sir, first let me say that I sincerely hope this letter reaches you. I do not have your home address, so I have taken the liberty of writing in care of your publisher. If they forward it to you, please let me know. I am not in the habit of writing to authors. This is the first time, so please bear with me if my letter is not perfect in spelling, etc. I've been reading your works for approximately 6 years, in other words, since shortly after I was married, but more about that later. Mr. Christian, Rex, if I may call you that, and I feel I can, you are my favorite author and greatest fan. Some people say you are too morbid and depressing, but I disagree. You do not write for children or women with weak hearts, I am guessing. But in your books, people always get what they deserve. No other author I have read teaches this so well. I can see why you are one of the most popular authors in the world. I have all 6 of your books. I hope there are only 6. I wouldn't like to think I missed any. If so, could you send me a list of the titles and where I might obtain them? A self-addressed envelope is enclosed for your convenience. Thank you. My favorite is The Silvering. I found that to be a very excellent plot. To tell the truth, it scared the shit out of me, if you know what I mean, and I think you do, right? Wink, wink. Moon Over the Nest is right up there, too. My wife introduced me to your novels. My ex-wife, I should say, and I guess I should thank her for that much. She left me 2.5 years ago, took the kids to San Diego first, and then to Salt Lake City, I found out later. I don't know why, she didn't say. I've tried to track her down, but no luck. Twice, with my late parents' help,
I found out where she was staying, but too late. So that is the way she wants it, I guess. I miss the kids, though, my little boy especially. In your next book, The Edge, I noticed you made one small mistake. I hope you don't mind my pointing it out. In that one, you have Morham killing his old girlfriend by electrocution before he does the other things to her, while she is setting up their word processor link. Excuse me, but this is wrong. I know this because I was employed in the computer field after dropping out of pre-med to support my family. The current utilized by a Mark 3A terminal is not enough to produce a lethal shock, even if the interface circuits were wired in sequence as you describe, which is impossible anyway. Sorry, just thought you might like to know. Also, the 0.66 nanosecond figure should be corrected. And so on in a familiar vein. Victor worked his way through three more densely packed pages of commentary and helpful advice regarding Rex Christensen's other bestsellers, including Jesus Had a Son, The Masked Moon, and the collection of short stories Nightmare Territory, before returning to more personal matters. If you ever find yourself in my neck of the woods, please feel free to drop by. We could have a few beers and sit up talking about the many things we have in common, like our love of old movies. I can tell you feel the same way about such classics as Robot Invaders, Mars vs. Earth, and House of Blood from the way you wrote about them in your series of articles for TV Guide. I subscribe so I wouldn't miss a single installment. There are others we could talk about, even watch if we're lucky. I got Channel 56 here in Gezerra. You may have heard about it. They show old chestnuts of that persuasion all night long. If you have not guessed by now, I too try my hand at writing occasionally myself. I have been working for the past 1.5 years on a story entitled Please, Please, Sorry, Thank You. It will be a very important story, I believe. Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to read it. You are probably too busy anyway. Besides, I read Writer's Digest so I know where to send it if and when I succeed in bringing it to a satisfactory stage of completion. But you are my inspiration. Without you, I would not have the courage to go on with it at all. He hesitated before the conclusion, as he had when first drafting it 4 nights ago. On the other side of the window pane, the sky was already smoking over with a fine mist, turning rapidly from the color of arterial blood to a dead slate gray. The sea rushed and drubbed at the coastline a mile to the west, shaking and steadily eroding the bedrock upon which his town was built. The vibrations which reached the glass membrane next to him were like the rhythms of a buried human heart. There is one more thing. I have a very important question to ask you. I hope you don't mind. It is a simple thing to you, and I'm sure you could answer it. You might say I should ask someone else, but the truth is I don't know anyone else who could help. What I know isn't enough. I thought it would be, but it isn't. It seems to me that the things we learned up until now, the really important things, and I can tell we've had many of the same experiences, the 60s, etc., when it came time to live them, the system balked. And we're dying. But don't worry, I'm a fighter. I learned a long time ago, never give up. I live in my parents' old house now, so we could have plenty of privacy. My opinion, we could help each other very much. My number is 474-2841. If I'm not here, I'll be at the Blue and White, corner of Rosetta and Damietta. That is where I work. Anybody can tell you where to find it. I hope to hear from you at your earliest convenience. Meanwhile, I'm waiting with bated breath for your book of essays, Other Sedans. They mentioned it on Wake Up America, and I can hardly wait. If you care to let me read the manuscript prior to publication, I promise to return it by express mail in perfect condition. Just asking, hint, hint. In any event, please come by for a visit on your next trip to the West Coast. I hope you will take me up on it sometime soon. I really need the answer. We horror fans have to stick together. As you said in your introduction to Nightmare Territory, it may be a long time till morning, but there is no law against talking in the dark. Faithfully yours, Victor Ripon. He sat back. He breathed in, out. It was the first breath he had been aware of taking for several minutes. The view from the window was no longer clear. A blanket of fog had descended to shroud all evidence of life outside his room. The puppies next door had quieted. resigned to their fate. Still, a hopeful smile played at the corners of his mouth. He stacked and folded the pages to fit the already stamped envelope. There. Now, there wasn't anything to do but wait. He stretched expansively, hearing his joints pop like dry bones, and his fingernails touched the window. So early, and yet the glass was chillingly brittle, ready to shatter under the slightest provocation. With any luck, he wouldn't have long to wait at all. The days shrank as the season contracted, drawing inward against the approaching winter. Trees bared stiffening limbs, scraped the sky and etched patterns of stars, as sharp and cold as diamond dust above the horizon. Victor got out his old army jacket. The main house became dank and tomb-like, magnifying the creaking of dry-rotted timbers. He took to sleeping in the guest cabin, though the portable heater kept him tight and shivering night after night. He pressed bravely ahead with his story, the outlines and preliminary versions of which by now filled two thick notebooks, reorganizing, redrafting, and obsessively repolishing lines and paragraphs with a jeweler's precision. But it was not good enough. He wanted the pages to sing with ideas that had once seemed so important to him. All and everything he knew. And yet they did not, and no amount of diligence was able to bring them to life. The story came to be a burden and weighed more heavily in his hands each time he lifted it out of the drawer. After a few weeks, he was reluctant to open the desk at all. He stayed in bed more and slept less, ragging himself up for work each day only at the last possible minute. Nothing except Rex Christian's books held any interest for him now, and he had read them all so many times he believed he knew them by heart, almost as well as his own stillborn effort. Channel 56 exhausted its library of late-night movies and sold out to a fundamentalist religious sect peddling fire and brimstone. The nights lengthened and the long winter closed around him. Each day he thought, I die a little. I must. I get out of bed, don't I? Mornings he walked the 2 miles along the creek into town, re-examining the last few years, like beads to be memorized in his pocketed fist before they slipped away forever. He walked faster, but his life only seemed to recede that much more swiftly across the dunes and back to the sea. He could neither hold on to nor completely forget how things had once been. Whether or not they had ever truly been the way he remembered them was not the point. The spell of the past, his past, real or imagined, had settled over him like the shadow of giant wings, and he could not escape. He submerged himself in his work at the shop, a space he rented for small appliance repair behind the blue and white diner. But that was not enough either. For a time he tried to tell himself that nothing else mattered, but it was an evasion. You can run, he thought, but you can't hide. Rex Christian had taught him that. Some days he would have traded anything he owned and all that he had ever earned to wake up one more time with that special smell of her on his pillow. Just that, no matter whether he ever actually set eyes on her again. Other days, his old revenge fantasies got the better of him. But all that was real for him now was the numbness of more and more hours at the shop, struggling to penetrate the inner workings of what others paid him to fix, the broken remnants of households which had fallen apart suddenly, without warning or explanation. When not busy at work, the smallest of rewards kept him going. The weekly changes of program at the local movie theater, diverting but instantly forgettable, the specialties of the house at the Blue and White, prepared for him by the new waitress whose name turned out to be Jolene, and Jolene herself when business was slow and there was nowhere else to go. She catered to him without complaint, serving something, perhaps, behind his eyes that he thought he had put to rest long ago. He was grateful to her for being there, but he could not repay her in kind. He did not feel it, could not even if he had wanted to. By late December, he had almost given up hope. The weekends were the worst. He had to get out. Buttoned against the cold, though, the coffee in town was never hot enough, and the talk after the movies was mindless and did not nourish. But he could bear the big house no longer, and even the guest cabin had begun to enclose him like a vault. This Saturday night, the last week before Christmas, the going was painfully slow. Steam expanded from his mouth like ectoplasm. He turned up his collar against an icy offshore wind. There were sand devils in the road, a halo around the ghost of a moon which hung over his shoulder and paced him relentlessly. At his side, To the north, dark reeds rustled and scratched the old river bank with a sound of rusted blades. He stuffed his hands deeper into his jacket and trudged on toward the impersonal glow of the business district. The neon above the blue and white burned coolly in the darkness. The nightlife in Gezira, such as it was, Siamese silhouettes of couples cruising for burgers, clutches of frantic teenagers on their way to or from the mall, appeared undiscouraged by the cold. If anything, the pedestrian scissoring by seemed less inhibited than ever, pumping reserves of adrenaline and huffing wraiths of steam, as if their last-minute shopping mattered more than anything else in this world. The bubble machine atop a police car revolved like a deranged Christmas tree light. Children giggled obscenities and fled as a firecracker resounded between lampposts. It might have been a gunshot. The patrol car spun out, burning rubber, and screeched past in the wrong direction. He took a breath, opened the door to the diner, and ducked inside. The interior was clean and bright as a hospital cafeteria. A solitary pensioner dawdled at the end of the counter, spilling coffee as he cradled a cup in both hands. Twin milkshake glasses, both empty, balanced near the edge. As Victor entered, jangling the bell, the waitress glanced up. She saw him and beamed. "Hi." "Hi yourself. I'll be a few more minutes. Do you mind? The night girl just called. She's going to be late." Jolene watched him as she cleaned off the tables, trying to read his face as if it were the first page of a test. Her eyes flickered nervously between his. "Take your time," he said. He drew off his gloves and shuffled up to the counter. "No hurry." "The movie. We won't miss anything." She blinked at him. "But I thought the last show..." "It starts," he said, "when we get there." "Oh," she finished the tables, clearing away the remains of what other people could not finish. "I see," she said. Are you all right?" "Yes." "Well, you don't sound like it." She looked at him as if she wanted to smooth his hair, take his temperature, and fold him in her big arms and stroke his head. Instead, she wiped her hands and tilted her face quizzically, keeping her distance. "How about something to eat?" "Just coffee," he said. "My stomach's..." He sought the precise word. It eluded him. He gave up. "It's not right." "Again?" "Again." He tried a smile. It came out wrong. "Sorry, maybe next time?" She considered the plate, which she had been keeping warm on the grill. It contained a huge portion of fried shrimp, his favorite. She sighed. The door jingled and a tall man came in. He was dressed like a logger or survivalist from up north, with plaid shirt, hiking boots, full beard, and long hair. Victor decided he had never seen him before, though something about the man was vaguely familiar. Jolene dealt out another set up of flatware. He didn't need a menu. He knew what he wanted. Victor considered the man, remembering the 60s. "That could be me," he thought. "I could have gone that way, too, if I had the courage. Look at him. He's better off. He doesn't have any attachments to shake. He opted out a long time ago, and now there's nothing to pull him down." Jolene set the man's order to cooking and returned to Victor. "It won't be long," she said. "I promise." She gestured at the old Zenith portable next to the cash register. "You want the TV on?" She needed to do something for him, Victor realized. She needed to. "Sure," he said agreeably. "Why not?" She flicked the knob. The nightly episode of a new religious game show, You Think That's Heavy, was in progress. In each segment, a downtrodden soul from the audience was brought on stage and led up a ramp through a series of possible solutions, including a mock employment bureau, a bank loan office, a dating service, a psychiatric clinic, and finally, when all else had failed, a preacher with shiny cheeks and an unnatural preoccupation with hair. Invariably, this last station of the journey was the one that took. Just now, a poor woman with three children and a husband who could not support them was sobbing her way to the top of the hill. "I hope to God she finds what she needs," Victor thought absently. "She looks like she deserves it. Of course, you can't tell. They're awfully good at getting sympathy. But someone will come down and set things right for her sooner or later. She'll get what she deserves, and it will be right as rain. I believe that. But what about the kids? They're the ones I'm worried about." At that moment, the door to the diner rang open, and several small children charged in, fresh from a spree on the mall, clutching a few cheap toys and a bag of McDonald's French fries. They spotted the big man in the red plaid shirt and ran to him, all stumbles and hugs. The man winked at Jolene, shrugged, and relocated to a corner booth. What are you going to do? He said helplessly. I reckon I got to feed him, right?
I'll get the children's menu, said Jolene.
You got any chili dogs? Said the man.
We came a long way. Don't have a whole lot left to spend.
Is that okay?
Give him the shrimp, suggested Victor. I can't handle it.
Jolene winked back.
I think we can come up with something, she said. The pensioner observed the children warily. Who would say what they might have brought up in with them? He obviously did not want to find out. His hands shook, spilling more coffee. It ran between his fingers as if his palms had begun to bleed. Well, thought Victor, maybe I was wrong. Look at the big guy now. He can't run away from it either. But it could be he doesn't want to. He's got them, and they'll stick by him no matter what. Lucky, I guess. What's his secret? Out on the sidewalk, passerbys hurried on their way, a look of expectation and dread glazing their eyes. Victor picked up his coffee. It was almost hot enough to taste. There was another burst of ringing. He braced himself, not knowing what to expect. He scanned the doorway. But this time, it was not a customer. It was a telephone. Jolene reached across the counter, pushing dirty dishes out of the way. One of the milkshake glasses teetered and smashed to the floor. At the end of the counter, the pensioner jumped as though the spirit of Christmas past had just lain its withered fingers on the back of his neck. What? Jolene bounced the receiver. I'm sorry, there's so much. Yes? I said. Yes, hold on. She passed the phone to Victor. It's for you, she said.
It is?
Sure, it is, she said. I can't tell if it's a...
Yes?
Victor?
Yeah?
Vic, said the reedy voice in the line. Great to get a hold of you, finally. This is Rex. Rex Christian.
Really? Said Victor, stunned.
Yep. Look, I'll be passing through your town in about, say an hour. I was just wondering, are you free tonight by any chance?
Sure. Don't say my name.
Okay, said Victor. I'm on my way from a meeting in San Francisco. Traveling incognito, you might say. You don't know how people can be if the word gets out. So I'd appreciate it if, you don't let on who you're talking to. Understand?
I understand.
It must be hard, he thought, being a celebrity.
I knew you would.
Victor cupped his hand around the mouthpiece. The old man from the end of the counter fumbled money from his coin purse and staggered out. Victor tried to say the right things. He wasn't ready. However, he remembered how to get to his own house. He gave directions from Highway 1, speaking as clearly and calmly as he could.
Who was that? Asked Jolene when he had hung up.
Nobody, said Victor.
What?
A friend, I mean.
He what?
I've got to meet him. I forgot. Her expression, held together until now by nervous anticipation, wilted before his eyes. The tension left her. Her posture sagged. Suddenly she looked older, overweight, lumpen. He did not know what to say. He grabbed his gloves and made ready to leave. She smoothed her apron head down, hiding a tick, and then made a great effort to face him. The smile was right, but the lines were deeper than ever before.
Call me, she said. If you want to, it's up to you. I don't care.
Jolene. No, really. I couldn't take the cold tonight anyway. I hope you have a nice meeting. I can tell it's important.
Business, he said. You know.
I know.
I'm sorry. She forced a laugh.
What on earth for?
Don't you worry.
He nodded, embarrassed.
Take care of yourself, she said.
You deserve better, he thought, than me, Jolene.
You too, he said. I didn't plan it this way. Please believe.
I believe you. Now get along or you'll be late.
He felt relieved. He felt awful. He felt woefully unprepared. But at least he felt something.
All the way home, the hidden river ran at his side, muffled by the reeds, but no longer distant. This time, he noted that there were secret voices in the waters, talking to themselves and to each other, to the night with the tongues of wild children on their way back to the sea. Now he considered the possibility that they might be talking to him. Victor unlocked the old house and fired up the heater. He had little chance to clean. By the time he heard the car, he was covered with a cold sweat, and his stomach, which he had neglected to feed, constricted in a hopeless panic. He parted the bathroom curtains. The car below was long and sleek. A limousine? No. But it was a late model sedan, a full-size Detroit tank with fog lights. A man climbed out, lugging a briefcase, and made for the front of the house. Victor ran downstairs and flung open the door. He saw a child approaching in the moonlight. It was the same person
he had seen leave the shadow of the car. From the upstairs window, the figure had appeared, deceptively foreshortened. The boy came into the circle of the porch light, sticking his chin out and grinning rows of pearly teeth. "Vic?" Victor was confused. Then he saw. It was not a child, after all. "I'm Rex Christensen," said the dwarf, extending a stubby hand. "Glad to meet you." The hand felt cold and compressed as a rubber ball in Victor's grip. He released it with an involuntary shudder. He cleared his throat. "Come on in. I've been expecting you." The visitor wobbled to an overstuffed chair and bounced up into the cushion. His round-toed shoes jutted out in front of him. "So, this is where one of my biggest fans lives." "I guess so," said Victor. "This is it." "Great." "It's perfect." On the stained wall, a grandfather clock sliced at the thick air. "Can I get you something?" Victor's own voice sounded hollow in his ears, like, "Something to drink?" "I'd settle for a beer. Just one, though. I want to keep a clear head." "Beer," thought Victor. "Let me see." He couldn't think. He looked away. The small face, the monkey mouth were too much for him. He wanted to laugh and cry at the same time. "You owe me, remember?" "What?" "The beer. In your letter, you said..." Oh, yeah. Just a minute." Victor went to the kitchen. By the time he returned, he had replayed his visitor's words in his mind until he recognized the rhythm. Everything the dwarf, midget, whatever he was, had said so far fit the style. There was no doubt about it. For better or worse, the person in the other room was in fact Rex Christian. The enormity of the occasion finally hit him. Setting the bottles on the coffee table between them, he almost knocked one over. "My time has come," he thought. "My problems are about to be over. My prayers have been answered." "This must be pretty far out of the way for you," Victor said. "Not at all. Thanks for the invitation." "Yeah," said Victor. I mean... And in that instant he saw himself, this house, his life, as it really was for the first time. He was overwhelmed with self-consciousness and shame. Did you have any trouble finding the place?"
"Nope."
"Followed your directions." "Perfect." Victor studied the vergils in the carpet, trying to find his next words there. Rex Christian leaned forward in his chair. The effort nearly doubled him over. "Look, I know what it's like for you."
"You do?"
"Believe me, I do. That's my business, isn't it? I've seen it all before." Rex sat back and took a long pull from the tall bottle. His Adam's apple rolled like a ball bearing in his throat.
"You must know a lot about people," said Victor.
"Never enough. That's why I take a trip like this at least once a year," he chortled. "I rent a car, visit folks like you all over the country. It's a way of paying them back. Plus, it helps me with my research."
"I see." There was an awkward pause.
You see, you were in San Francisco on business. Was that part of this year's trip?"
"Right. Nothing beats the old one-on-one, does it?"
"So he didn't come all this way just to see me," thought Victor. "There were others." "From your writing, well, I thought you'd be a very private person."
"I am.
Somebody wants a book, they have to climb the mountain. But when it comes to my fans, it's a different story. They're raw material. I go to the source. Know what I mean?"
"I used to be a people person," said Victor, loosening up a bit. He drained his bottle. He thought of going for two more, but the rider had hardly touched his. "Now, well, I don't go out much. I guess you could say I've turned into more of a project-type person."
"Glad to hear it."
"You are?"
"It just so happens I've got a project you might be interested in. A new book. It's called A Long Time Till Morning."
"I like the title," said Victor.
"Excuse me." He rose unsteadily and made a beeline for the stairs. The beer had gone through his system in record time. When he came out of the bathroom, he gazed down in wonderment from the top of the landing. Rex Christian was still sitting there, stiff and proper as a ventriloquist dummy. "I can't believe this is happening," he thought. "Now everything's changed. There he is, sitting in my living room." His heart pounded with exhilaration. "Let me never forget this. Every minute, every second, every detail. I don't want to miss a thing. This is important. This matters. The most important night of my life." He bounded down the stairs and snagged two more beers and an opener from the kitchen and then reseated himself on the sofa. Rex Christian greeted him with a sparkling grin.
"Tell me about your new book," said Victor breathlessly.
"I want to hear everything. I guess I'll be the first, won't I?"
One of the first, the author folded his tiny hands. It's about an epidemic that's sweeping the country. I don't have the details yet. I'm still roughing it out. All I gave my editor was a 2-page outline. And he bought it? Rex Christian grinned. What kind of epidemic? That's where you can help, Vic. If it's research you want, well, just tell me what you need. I used to do a lot of that in school. I was in pre-med, and I want to make this as easy as possible for you. I'm sure you do, but it's no sweat. I'll collect the data, Xerox articles, send you copies of everything that's ever been written on the subject as soon as you tell me. Rex Christian frowned, his face wrinkling like a deflated balloon. I'm afraid that would involve too many legalities. Copyrights, fees, that sort of thing. Sources that might be traced. We could get permission, couldn't we? You wouldn't have to pay me. It would be an honor to... I know, Rex Christian's miniature fingers flexed impatiently. But that's the way around, my friend. However, you want to do it, say the word, and I'll get started. First thing in the morning, Monday morning. Tomorrow's Sunday, and... Monday's too late. It starts now. In fact, it's already started. You didn't know that, did you? Rex's face flushed eagerly, his cheeks red as a newborn's infant's. I want to know your feelings on the subject. All of them. He pumped his legs and crept forward on the cushion. Open yourself up. It won't hurt. I promise. Victor's eyes stung and his throat ached. It starts here, he thought, awestruck. The last 33 years were the introduction to my life. Now it really starts. You wouldn't want to know my feelings, he said. I've been pretty mixed up for a long time. I don't care about what you felt before. I want to know what you feel tonight. It's only you, Vic. You're perfect. I can't get that in any library. Do you know how valuable you are to me? But why? Your characters, they're so much more real, more alive. Rex waved his words aside. An illusion. Art isn't life, you know. If it were, the world would all go up in flames. It's artifice. By definition. He slid closer, his toes finally dropping below the coffee table. Though naturally I try to make it echo real life as closely as I can. That's what turns my readers on. That's part of my mission. Don't you understand? Victor's eyes filled with tears. Other people, the people he saw and heard on the screen, on TV and books and magazines, voices on the telephone, all had lives which were so much more vital than his own wretched existence. The closest he had ever come to peak experiences, the moments he found himself returning to again and again in his memory, added up to nothing more than significant than chance meetings on the road. Like the time he hitchhiked to San Francisco in the summer of 67, a party in college where no one knew his name. The face of a girl in the window of a passing bus that he had never been able to forget. And now, he lowered his head to his knees and wept. And in a blinding flash, as if the scales had been lifted from his eyes, he knew that nothing would ever be the same for him again. The time to hesitate was over. The time had come at last to make it real. He thought, I am entitled to a place on the planet. After all, he lifted his eyes to the light. The dwarf's face was inches away, the diminutive features, the taut lips, the narrow brow, the close-lidded eyes, wise and all-forgiving, the sweet scent of an unknown aftershave lotion wafted from his skin. The past doesn't matter, said the dwarf. He placed the short fingers of one hand on Victor's head. To hell with it all. Yes, said Victor, for so long he had thought just the opposite, but now he saw a way out. Oh, yes. Tell me what you feel from this moment on, said the dwarf. I need to know. I don't know how, said Victor. Try. Victor stared into the dark, polished eyes, shiny as a doll's eyes. I want to. I don't know if I can. Of course you can. We're alone now. You didn't tell anyone I was coming, did you, Vic? Victor shook his head. How thoughtful, said the dwarf. How perfect. Like this house, a great setting. I could tell by your letter you were exactly what I need. Your kind always are. Those who live in out-of-the-way places, the quiet ones with no ties, that's the way it has to be. Otherwise, I couldn't use you. Why do you care what I feel? Asked Victor. I told you, research. It gives my work that extra edge. Won't you tell me what's happening inside you right now, Vic? I want to, I do. Then you can. You can if you really want to. Aren't we all free to do whatever we want?
I almost believe that once, said Victor.
Anything, said the dwarf firmly.
You can have anything including what you want most, especially that.
And what is it you want, Vic?
I want to write, I guess.
The dwarf's face crinkled with amusement.
But I don't know what to write about, said Victor.
Then why do you want to do it?
Because I have no one to talk to.
No one who could understand.
And what would you talk to them about if you could?
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
I'm afraid.
Tell me, Vic. I'll understand. I'll put it down exactly the way you say it. You want me to relieve your fear? Well, in another minute, I'm going to do that little thing. You have nothing more to fear. Ever again.
This is it, Victor thought. Your chance. Don't blow it. It's happening just the way you had it planned. Don't lose your nerve. Ask the question now. Do it.
But where does it come from? Asked Victor. The things you write about. How do you know what to say?
Where do you get it?
I try. But the things I know aren't...
You want to know? Said the dwarf, his face splitting in an uproarious grin.
Where I get my ideas? Is that your question?
Well, as a matter of fact...
From you, Vic.
I get my material from people like you. I get them from the cesspool you call life itself. And you know what? I'll never run out of material. Not as long as I go directly to the source. Because I'll never, ever finish paying you all back.
Victor saw then the large pores of the dwarf's face, the crooked bend to the nose, the sharpness of the teeth in the feral mouth, the steely glint deep within the black eyes. The hairs prickled on the back of his neck, and he pulled away. Tried to pull away, but the dwarf's hands stayed on his head.
Take my new novel, for instance. It's about an epidemic that's going to sweep the nation, leaving a bloody trail from one end of this country to the other, to wash away all of your sins. At first, the police may call it murder, but the experts will recognize it as suicide, a form of harakiri, to be precise, which is what it is.
I know because I've made a careful study of the methods.
Perfect.
The underdeveloped features, the cretinous grin filled Victor with sudden loathing and a terrible fear he could not name touched his scalp. He sat back, pulling further away from the little man. But the dwarf followed him, stepping onto the table, one hand still pressing Victor in a grotesque benediction. The lamp glared behind his oversized head, his eyes sparkling maniacally. He rose up and up, unbending his legs, locking over the bottles, standing taller until he blocked out everything else. Victor braced against the table and kicked away, but the dwarf leaped onto his shoulders and rode him down. Victor reached out, found the bottle opener, and swung it wildly.
No, he screamed, my God, no, you're wrong. It's a lie, you're...
He felt the point of the church key hook into something thick and cold and began to rip. But too late, a malformed hand dug into his hair and forced his head back, exposing his throat and chest.
How does this feel, Vic?
I have to know. Tell my readers. The other claw darted into the briefcase and dragged forth a blade as long as a bayonet, its edge crusted and sticky, but still razor sharp.
How about this? Cried the dwarf. And this!
As Victor raised his hand to cover his throat, he felt the first thrust directly below the ribcage. An almost painless impact, as though he had been struck by a fist in the chest, followed by the long sawing cut through his vital organs, and then the warm pumping of his life's blood down the short sword between them. His fingers tingled and went numb as his hands were wrapped into positions around the handle. The ceiling grew bright, and the world spun, hurling him free.
"Tell me," demanded the dwarf.
A great whispering chorus was released within Victor at last, rushing out and rising like a tide to flood the earth, crimson as the rays of a hellishly blazing sun. But his mouth was choked with his own blood, and he could not speak, not a word of it. The vestiges of a final smile moved to his glistening lips.
"Tell me," shrieked the dwarf, digging deeper, while the room turned red.
"I must find the perfect method. Tell me!"